Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, Dom here. Welcome to my podcast. This episode is brought to you by a couple of fantastic Kiwi companies, Radix Nutrition and Generate Kiwi Saver. Coming up, Rob Mokadaka.
So, you know, the police officer did say don't take another step. And I took that step. So I got that 9mm bullet into me, ripped through my internal organs, dropped me, and I realised I made a terrible mistake.
This is usually the point where I bring the music in, but I think I'll talk without music to get this message out there. This episode needs to come with a big warning. This is a dark episode. It's ugly in parts, brutally ugly. But I still feel like these are not topics that we should shy away from because life's not always beautiful. It can and it will be bleak at times. Rob Mokadaka is a mental health advocate who's doing incredible work educating people through his own harrowing story. His life looks a lot different now to how it did in July 2009. That was when he had a rock bottom moment where he decided to end his own life in one of the most violent ways imaginable. At any point during this podcast, if you feel the need to speak to a professional, either for yourself or for someone you care about, there is a list of resources in the description for this episode which I urge you to use. Remember, it's not weak to speak. There's a line that I really like. Asking for help is not giving up. It's refusing to give up. Massive thanks to my sponsors, Radix and Generate, for their support in making these conversations possible. I am so incredibly lucky. These are two Kiwi-owned companies who reached out to me about podcast collaborations. Look, I'm not your mum. I can't tell you what to do. But it would mean a lot to me if you backed the businesses who have taken a leap of faith with this new and innovative way of marketing by backing a podcast. This podcast has grown in ways that I could never have foreseen this year. And a lot of that is because of the backing of Radix Nutrition, which are, in my opinion, the best thing to come out of the Waikato since the Chiefs. And their products are the tastiest thing to come out of the Waikato since Richard Kahui. Again, my opinion. I've tasted the entire Radix range. I've never actually tasted Richard Kahui. But boy, he looks delicious. I start every day with a Radix protein shake. Their products are world class. And this is the honest truth. Even if they stopped sponsoring the podcast, I would continue using their products because they are that good. Check them out. RadixNutrition.co.nz. That's R-A-D-I-X. And the newest podcast sponsor, Generate KiwiSaver, who are now officially my KiwiSaver provider. I switched over as a way of thanking them for their support, and it was easier and quicker than I expected, and totally pain-free. Actually, form-free as well. All I needed was some ID and my IRD number. Learn more for yourself at generatewealth.co.nz. There you will find a copy of their product disclosure statement, and the issuer is Generate Investment Management Limited. Okay, let's get into the episode. Rob Mokadaka on the Dom Harvey podcast.
Hey, brother.
Hey, thank you so much for coming over and joining me on my podcast.
Bro, thanks for inviting me in. Appreciate it, bro.
Oh, you've got a hell of a story. I actually don't have any questions for this podcast, but I thought we'd just work in... it's just such a unique and terrifying story. I feel like if we just go in chapters, I'll just follow my nose. I thought we could start on the day, yeah, which is July 2009. Yeah. Then we'll go to the lead up, growing up, the moments that led to that moment, the recovery and court case, and then rebuilding Rob.
Yeah.
And where you're at now.
Yeah, great.
Four chapters. Okay, so first of all, can I say... July 2009, I was living in a suburb not far from where we are now called Westmere, which is like close. One suburb over from Point Chef. So when this came on the news, it sort of captivated me, and I'd never ever heard before that moment of the phrase suicide by cop. Had never heard it before.
Yeah.
And that was you on the news. So talk us through that day.
So I had a very public mental and spiritual breakdown. I'd broken up from a relationship. It was unhealthy, and I helped destroy that even more, and it blew up. And I thought, I'll get even clearer. To get out of this crazy relationship, I did something even more crazier and stupid, and I went and slept with somebody else to make sure it really exploded.
Oh, so self-destruct.
Self-destruct. Yeah. I wanted it to really explode. And I called the police on myself. I called the police on myself because I thought I was the biggest pile of crap in the world. No one will ever forgive me for all the things that I'd compiled. I built a case against myself. And all the floodgates from the past just burst open. So it's like the past, present, future is all converging all at once. And you're hurt, scared, angry, confused. And I thought, I don't want to be alive. And I thought, I know. I've seen police shoot Māori on the news, right or wrong. I'm a Māori. This should be easy. And I thought I deserved a violent death. So I called the police up, brother. Called them on myself. And ended up being shot in the chest at close range by provoking the police to shoot me dead.
The whole thing is just awful, and there's so much to unpack here. I've heard the 111. I'm sorry for laughing. No, I've heard right. The 111 call. You're wearing a t-shirt now that says "Shot, Bro."
Yeah.
For anyone that wants to watch your play or documentary. Yeah, it's on YouTube. You can just look up "Shot, Bro" and you'll find it. It starts with the 111 call, yeah. And then the video footage. It's very difficult to watch, but. You hear the call, you call yourself and you describe yourself, and you're wearing like costume camouflage gear.
Well, I'm wearing World War II trousers from a theatre show that I co-wrote and co-acted in, and I'm wearing an Air Force Army trench coat, which a good friend of mine gave to me as a present. So I'm looking like somebody's having a massive mental breakdown who looks pretty crazy dressed in military regalia. Mm. So I was pretty much dressing the part. And freaking the police out.
Yeah, so you had a knife in one hand, and in the other hand you had like a ladle covered with a...
Tea towel.
So they'd think that was a gun.
Yeah, so I had it was a meat cleaver and a soup ladle wrapped in a tea towel. And I went out there wanting to be just... I just wanted it to end. And I wanted this hurt to stop in my mind. And, so you know, the police officer did say, don't take another step. And I took that step. And guess what happens when you take that step? And they say, don't take another step. So I got that 9mm bullet into me, ripped through my internal organs, dropped me, and I realised I made a terrible mistake.
Yeah, and you can hear that in the footage, because there were camera crews that made it there in time. You were yelling out over and over again, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, yeah, and I've had quite a few people ask me, who are you sorry to, Rob? And I had to think about it, and I was like, I think I was sorry to the policeman, or I was freaking out. Mm. I was sorry to everybody I may have hurt in my life growing up. It was just all these sorries compounded from childhood.
So just going back a little bit, so the police turn up, then how long is that whole interaction?
I don't know. Time,
right.
Time is just right. Is blurred.
Right, so you hear this, you're in the house, you hear the sirens that you called on yourself, and then you come out on the street?
So I called the police and I was wondering, on myself, and I was wondering why no one has come into the house. In my mind, they're going to burst in, blow me away, and that's the end of Rob.
Yeah.
But no one was coming in the house and I was getting frustrated, so I went outside onto the street. And, that's where they were outside, because I did call them.
Mm. And they're how far away from you? So you're on the street, one's hiding behind a tree, yes. One's hiding behind the police car. Like yeah. 20 metres, 15 metres?
Oh, it's, yeah, around about 15 metres.
Right.
And they're not that far away, brothers. And so...
And do they try and negotiate with
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, this police officer's trying to reach out to me and ask me what my name is and trying to reach out, but I'm in this... A full storm. I call it the storm of suicidal ideation, where I was like, don't try and reach out to me. And I think I may have said my name. I did say my name, actually. And so I said my name. What's your name? I said my name. And like, and this has got my other inner voice, which is all in shot representation, and my inner voice going, my inner critic or my inner taniwha saying, why the hell did you tell him your name? And basically, it was kind of like I was trying to reach out through the storm myself. But he did warn me. They said, what's in the tea towel? I said, you know what's in the tea towel. They said, don't take another step. I took that step and bang, shot in the chest at close range.
But it missed your vital organs?
No, it cut through my organs.
Right.
And it was stuck inside of me, so they couldn't find it.
How are you not? How did you not die?
That's a great question. That's a great question.
There must be like a purpose, right? There's got to be a reason.
Absolutely. And so my grandmother, she's from the Hokianga, so very much a Hokianga Catholic. She said, you know, I gave you the Archangel Michael medal, and it's because of I gave you this medal, you're alive. And whatever the reasons are, it's to give me a second chance. And with that second chance, I'm going around Australasia to communities and organisations to normalize this conversation using humor and lived experience to open up those very heavy, crunchy doors we are uncomfortable about addressing.
Yeah, bro. And the work you've done since this happened, the darkest day of your life, it's incredible. It's inspirational and it's phenomenal. And I guess I wonder if that's the purpose that you survived.
I feel it is. Yeah. I definitely feel it is. I was at a mental health grassroots conference in Hastings, and I presented, and one of the other presenters came up to me. He literally rolled up to me in a wheelchair. His name is Wayne Forrest. He's a really good man. And he rolled up to me after listening to me, and he said, he looked up at me and he said, you know, that happened to you for a reason. And part of that reason is for you to send this message out to people.
Yeah.
And I didn't know his story. I looked at this man in a wheelchair and I was thinking, what happened to him? And then I get to hear his story about a rugby-playing farmer who went into a tackle, rugby tackle, and never came out of it. So everyone's got a story. It's just, I suppose, the key thing I'm meeting from people who have gone through trauma is from the ashes, hope rises. Yeah. And it's creating hope in different communities.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, So you get shot. So you're lying on the ground, repeatedly shouting out, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." Then what happens? Do you black out? You pass out?
No, I'm still awake because the bullet is searing my internal organs. It's on fire.
Yeah, because I would say you're the only person I'll ever have the privilege of speaking to that's been shot in the chest and survived. So, yeah, describe that pain.
Once again, quite a few people have asked that question. What does it feel like? It's like having a hot iron poker in the fire, and then someone stabs it inside of you, and it doesn't stop burning. So it's like sizzling your internal organs. So the suicidal storm that's going in my mind is now overridden by the burning internal organs. So now it's like, that's not a problem. But the problem's down here now, brother. And I am just in a whole world of pain in a different way. And from the healing process, I've met a lot of people, and I realize, meeting lots of different people around Australasia, is that people don't want to kill themselves. They just want the hurt to stop up here.
100%. Absolutely.
And I'm one of those people who survived that, and a lot of people don't. So I'm very blessed to get a second chance at life.
Mm. So when you're down on the road, saying I'm so sorry over and over again, searing pain in your chest, do the cops come up and check on you? Or do
the cops come up. Yeah. And one officer compresses my wound. I'm in so much pain, that bullet is like, so it's like burning. It's on the angle of the bullet, and it's so intensely painful. And I remember a police officer come down and compressed the wound. He compressed the wound, and it just eased the burning for just a little bit, just enough for me to breathe. And I ended up meeting that policeman.
So that wasn't the one that shot you, that was his
No,
partner.
This is another guy.
Yeah.
There's another story to this. Mm. So that police officer who compressed my wound, we invited him to Shot Bro years later because he contacted my agent, just wanted to say, hey, look, I saw a short interview with you and I just want to commend you for how far you've come. I went, oh, who's this again? Well, I'm the officer who compressed your wound. And I was like, wow. So, yeah, his job, a lot of people don't know this. He told me once he watched Shot Bro, I was at Hwani Waititi Kurakaupapa Marae at the school, and he came and watched. And he watched Shot Bro, and he was blown away just by he didn't know what the background story was. And he said, well, I'm glad you didn't point that tito at me. And I said, why is that? Because I was hiding in the bushes with an assault rifle. If that officer missed, my job was to finish you off. So everything happened in the right form, in the right way. For a reason for me to still be alive and to meet that officer and give him an apology letter from me to the officer who pulled the trigger, who I provoked. And it's an apology letter handwritten with all my contact details because he said, look, if you really want to get in contact with him, give me that letter, because I went through official channels to try and apologize.
Yeah.
Nothing. Yeah. But anyway, through this officer, this that policeman who I provoked to shoot me has gotten my full apology.
But he, as far as you know, then he hasn't sort of accepted it.
I don't know. Yeah. The main thing is I know he's got it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got friends who are in the police. I've got cousins, and they said, well, that dude will be pretty messed up.
Yeah. And, can you imagine? I'm sure – I don't want to dwell on this because I know you feel like shit about this. But, yeah, like can you imagine just the hell it would have created for his life had he killed you?
Well, yep, and look at it this way. We had a rangatira at that Huane Waititi presentation of Shopper, and he said everybody was doing their job on the day. You were doing your job. That policeman was doing his job. The policeman who compressed your wound, he was doing his job. So if you take the emotion out, everybody was doing their job, and it's a crazy job.
Mm.
And thankfully, I'm alive to be able to apologise to that police officer and the other officer who compressed my wound.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. So do you pass out at all before the ambulance?
No, I'm
in and out. You're coherent the whole time.
I'm like burning. I'm a sausage sizzle lying down on the ground. I'm like at my own barbecue, and it's an internal barbecue.
So you remember everything.
I can remember.
How did you not pass out?
Well, I was thinking I was in and out just going, ah, I was thinking I was yelling out, where's the ambulance? And it seemed to take an eternity while you're sizzling on the ground. And then it finally turns up, and they chuck me on the gurney, they put me in, and then I remember yelling out to put me some drugs in me, but they weren't sure how much they should put in. I was in a world of chaos. So I passed out in the ambulance, then I reawoke as we arrived at the hospital.
So at that point in the ambulance, when you're lying on the road, you must be thinking, I'm gonna die.
I wanted to die.
Yeah.
Because I'm disappointed that I'm still alive.
Yeah.
And I'm actually yelling at the police to shoot me in the head. But it's
like finish you off.
Yeah, finish me off, because the pain is so extreme that I don't think I can actually, the mind can't process the extremity of the bullet burning my internal organs. So I'm actually yelling out, but it's a beautiful afternoon in a sunny Point Chevalier, Auckland. And people are looking out their windows going, who is this crazy maniac the police had to shoot? So, you know, living off all of that to go, when I see shootings now, if I hear anything about people jumping off, I go, what's the real story behind the article?
Mm.
That's how I look at the news. What's the real story? Because that's just the headline.
Yeah. So then you're taken to hospital. What does the recovery look like? Do they put you in a coma? They put you on enough morphine to knock you out for how many days?
I remember not many days. I remember them cutting my clothes off and putting some drugs in me, and I passed out just then.
Okay.
And then I woke up in the hospital room, and it was like a big shock. It's like now I'm in a new world, and the new world is I've got my guts cut wide open, and it is extremely painful. And the first thing I think about when hospital is, I hope my dad doesn't know. So that's the first person I thought of was my dad.
Why? Because the embarrassment or shame? Or
yes, absolutely. I've brought all this embarrassment and shame all upon the family, and now everyone's going to know that I'm an effing loser, I'm an effing piece of this and that and blah, blah, blah. Which
reinforces the story you'd been telling yourself.
Yes, I'd been telling myself that for a while. Even though I was the smiley guy, making people laugh, making them feel good, and behind closed doors, I'd just be exhausted.
But isn't it funny that was your first thought? You think your first thought would be, oh, fuck, I failed, I'm still here, or, oh, my God, I survived, this is amazing, this is my second chance. But no. How much time had passed, like, between being taken to hospital and you're coming out of sedation?
Oh,
so. Do you know, like a day, 2 days?
A day.
A day.
I think it was the next day.
And then what happens?
I've got police in my room now watching.
Oh, like police guard?
Yeah, police guard, just in case I miraculously get out of bed, which I can't move. So the police are guarding somebody who can't move, who's got his guts cut wide open, and I suppose they're just following procedure. And I'm messed up, and I meet Obi-Wan Kenobi, a.k.a. my new lawyer. And he comes from upstairs out of the blue, Silverhead Fox, and he introduces himself. He's a QC. And I thought, I don't trust any lawyers. Why would I trust the lawyers? But he's actually a really good man. And he informs me there's a whole bunch of people downstairs in the hospital waiting room who care about me. And I didn't know that because in my mind, no one cares about me.
Yeah.
In my mind, I'm not worth anything. So
yeah, you thought everyone else would be better off without you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Please, you're gone. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's the usual that I'm meeting people around Australasia, and I've seen interviews on documentaries about this. Is like people feel like they're doing people a favour.
Yeah, they think they're a burden.
Absolutely.
100%. And it goes back to what you were saying before about no one actually wants to die. They just want the hurt to stop.
Yes.
And they want to stop being an embarrassment or a burden to others.
Yes.
Yeah. So then what's the recovery like? What's that process or procedure?
Long time.
Like weeks, months?
So I'm 7 weeks in Auckland Hospital with my guts cut. What happened? So the emergency surgery I had, the bullet was still stuck inside me, so it was still making me sick. So I was spewing up green bile because this bullet is, and they can't see or find the bullet on CT scans or x-rays. It's actually hidden behind my lung. But there was some unrelated problem on my back because I'm lying on my back, and I had to get the doctor, one of the prettiest doctors I've ever seen. Well, she seemed pretty amazing at the time.
Maybe it was the morphine.
Maybe it could have been the morphine. But she said, hey, did they find that bullet? And I went, no. And she went, okay. So she starts digging into my back. They give me lots more morphine and plunk, digging around, and she pulls out some rib because they had to crack my ribs to try and find the bullet. Oh. So they cut me open and crack the ribs. They can't find the bullet. So she digs in the back and she pulls out a little piece of rib and she keeps digging. And she pulls out the bullet, and she goes, I found it. And I was like, can I have a look at it? I was like, you little bastard. But I was...
It's only a tiny little thing.
Yeah, Glock 9mm bullet.
Right.
Yeah, it's not a rifle bullet. Yeah, just a pistol bullet.
Amazing.
So she pulled it out.
Is there much of a scar, or is it just like a tiny little...
Well, not anymore, but it's the actual surgery, cutting open multiple times. So I had to have emergency second surgery, and then in that second surgery, they had to... Because my bowels were cut by the bullet and my spleen, so they had to give me a colostomy bag. So now I was basically shitting out my guts from then on in for 4 months until I had a reversal operation. So I'm in pain 7 days a week. 24 hours, and this time I can't hide because a lot of things we can do, we can distract ourselves more. Yeah. Mental issues, there's no hiding anymore. Mm. It's quite a freaky movie that everything is loud, bright, and clear. The pain, the people in the room, me, I'm present for the first time, fully present, and it sucks.
did it suck, or was it like a, I don't know, like a weight off your shoulders in a way, because it's like now I've finally got a face the Tunny Fowl or whatever.
No, I wasn't. No. I was nowhere near there.
Okay.
I was still in the multiple concrete barriers that helped me hide all this pain. So I was just like, man, I'm in pain. I said, when this shit's going to ever end?
Mm.
So I'm still having police in there. My lawyer ended up we had a court case in my room. The lawyer was present, actually told the police off for trying to rush the court case without them present. And then we had court case to get the police out of the room because my lawyer said, I can see they're not conducive to your priests and healing, having them in the room, stressing me out. And so from that day on, I didn't have police monitoring me, and it was a very much more peaceful, well, semi-peaceful healing process. Just physical pain, bro. When you're in physical pain, you're burning, your internal organs, you're cut open multiple times. It's hard to rest.
Mm. When does the physical pain stop? You're not in any pain now?
No.
No.
But I have to... So 9 weeks all up in hospitals,
yep.
And I have to learn how to change my own wounds. I have to learn how to change my own shit bags, my own colostomies. So basically I'm dealing with my own shit every day. No shit, real shit. My own shit. And I thought, this is crazy. I'm having to deal with this shit, which is burning my guts where they had to do emergency operation. I've got my own wounds that I have to tend to, which a nurse helped me tend. So I'm having to look at this and having to deal with and trying to find out how I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And my family, I'm recovering after I got out of family, at a hospital at my family's homestead up in Whangarei. So it's freaked them out because they're bombarded by media as well. And no one's trained in media negotiations.
Yeah.
They're just trying to help crazy Rob, their son, their nephew, their grandson.
Mm. Man, all right. Well, let's go backwards, and then we'll go forward to the recovery and the court case and stuff. So, you've dealt with the, call it what you want, the taniwha, the black dog, yeah, depression, whatever. You this had been like a recurring thing all the way through your adult life. Like I read you got admitted to a psych ward when you were like 21, 22?
Yes, absolutely, 21, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, another mental breakdown, psychiatric unit, king seat. And
what was that like?
Wow, that was like a crazy one flew out of the cuckoo's nest. If you've ever seen that movie, yeah, anyway, you are
Jack
laughing.
Nicholson and the Chief.
So that's right. I thought it was Jack Nicholson. I thought I was the sanest person there.
You're going to Nurse Ratched. I don't belong here. I'm not like them.
Well, that's what it felt like.
Yeah,
that's what it felt like.
Is that
like
the right place to send a dude in his early 20s that's just having
Well, you look, my parents signed the papers, and my parents were divorced, and they were like, we don't know what to do with Rob. This is freaking us out.
Yeah.
Because I'd actually had an incident with the police again. So
what was that?
Well, I was I went to the farm, to my dad's farm, when I was 21, to go and blow my head off with a 22. So the police got involved, and I had to go to shit, man. There was multiple times. Multiple things.
Yeah, I read there was one day somewhere in your 20s where you like
three times.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tried to gas myself, drown myself, and then the third one was to try and blow my head off. So there was one little angel saying on my shoulder saying, "What if it could be better?" And the other one saying, "You know what to do. Let's clock out. Let's get out of here."
But then, so that's in your early 20s. Then between that and July 2009, when the police shot you, so much good stuff happened in your life,
so
right?
So much good stuff
happened. So there was 2007, you won some big award for a play that you did.
Yes.
2009, like just before the shooting, you're over in London with some play. Like from an outsider's perspective, everything was going good in your life. You were humming.
Yeah, that's right.
You had a four-year-old daughter as well at the same time.
Yes, who's now 19. And
we'll get to that later.
Yeah, and I say this, on the outside, it looked like I was living the dream, but my whole life was falling apart. And all the shame, guilt, and failure stopped me from telling my friend who's just as far away as you are. Actually, I just had lunch with him before I arrived. Mm. So it was like all the shame, guilt, and failure was choking me to not say a word, to say, hey, man, I'm in deep distress, I'm freaking out. Mm. I actually didn't know, I didn't have the words.
Yeah.
And now.
What was the I don't know if you want to get into this or not, but what was the cause of the shame, guilt, and failure? Because like from an outsider's perspective, you definitely weren't a fucking failure. Like no, you were doing like professionally at least, you were doing very well.
Yes, I was, but I suppose because I had unresolved trauma, which I didn't know, I had all this. Well, I'll get into it. It's like so. There's a trail. So every stuff that happens to us on the surface, if you're brave enough, you follow the rabbit warren down, you'll find the core.
Like pulling on a thread of a T-shirt or something.
Yes, absolutely. And it's one of the most scariest journeys that people don't want to go on. That's why they have multiple therapies or, well, they're just on the piss taking drugs to help numb it. And I've played that game. Try and drink my way out of the hurt. So unresolved trauma, and part of that was I had, when I was a young man, I had three abortions with two girlfriends, and it was just all the shame that I was too young to, and they were too young. And the parents were, no, they've got a future. Why are we going to have, you've just messed up these people's lives. So I'm holding on to those, shame, guilt.
But did you sort of like pressure them into it, or was it a mutual, you just felt bad because?
No, I was young. I was like literally like 15, 18, and then 25.
Why did you hold shame about that?
Because that's a great – because I've done something wrong. So if I use these words right, and I'll steal them from Brené Brown.
How good is Brené Brown?
I'm a big fan. I feel like she's my auntie. But so she said guilt is I did something wrong. Shame is I am something wrong. And I felt both of those things. I did something wrong. I am something wrong. And then I'm just going to move forward. So as I move forward doing Shopper, in the first year I had to go see a shrink again. Thanks to Mike King, he shouted me a shrink because I hadn't seen one for a while. And all the stuff started to come out, being sexually molested. And I thought I was holding memories for somebody else. That's how my mind was dealing with this. Oh, you're holding like a memory stick. Someone gave me a memory stick. Oh, these aren't my memories. Mm. I must be holding this for somebody else. And I didn't realize that those memories were my memories of me that I'd suppressed. So I've got all this stuff suppressed, brother. That's and when I meet people who've been through trauma, even worse, way worse than I've been, we compartmentalize it to survive. So we pack it away to try and move on. But you don't realize throughout your life you're fight, flight, or freeze.
Yeah.
And your interactions, you don't even know that, are guided by those three pillars. And so you, when you don't know what's wrong with you, you'll just keep continuing this way of behaving. Mm. And when I meet other people like me, male and female, who've been on the journey, we've got so many similar traits.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing this podcast for about a year and a half now, and I've interviewed maybe 70 or 80 people. And one thing you realize is everyone is carrying around a bag of shit. It's just how big that bag of shit is. I've actually found this quite cathartic. It's like therapy in its own
absolutely.
Sort of way.
Yeah, I totally get it. Yeah. I find what I do in my presentations to be quite cathartic and like a physical, mental, spiritual outlet to help others show them like, hey, man, you're not crazy. You're hurting. Because I was told I was crazy. And then either that or I was dismissed.
Yeah, who told you were crazy?
People were telling me crazy.
Right.
And I'm saying, you know, and thing about families, if families don't want to deal with your mental illness, which is, I'm not blaming families, I'm just saying they don't have the tools to deal with it. And our parents' generation and our grandparents' generation, this was one of the ultimate shames to have somebody with mental, having a mental breakdown. So all of that stuff was buried and you're dismissed. Mm. You're either dismissed and dissolved or told to just shut your mouth.
Yeah. Because how old are you? What are you now?
I've just turned 50.
50. So you're exactly the same age as me. See, I've heard you do some speeches and stuff, and you've talked about how it's a Māori thing or a thing that happens in whānau, but I'm exactly the same age as you. My family was the same, and I went to an all-boys school, and it's like you'd never show the Brené Brown stuff that you're talking about. You never show any sort of vulnerability. You never cry. Like it was how we were raised. It was the waters we were swimming
absolutely,
in.
Absolutely, brother. Absolutely.
So it's trying to sort of unpick all that. And
absolutely. And then I've got a father who was in the army.
Yeah.
So you definitely, a father also in the Vietnam War. Mm. So
he was dealing with his own trauma.
He's dealing with his own stuff, but you don't know that because you're a kid, right? Yeah. And you're a kid, and you don't know that your mum and dad are going through stuff. And sometimes you think it's your fault, and what the arguments are, but they're dealing with real human issues. Mm. Human issues.
Yeah.
Pay the mortgage, the job, the kids, the food, the schooling, you know?
Yeah.
All of that, and you don't realise that. And so I've got way more... more aroha for my parents realizing shit, they're pretty young trying to work shit out.
Mm.
And society's got this unwritten rule that you get to a certain age, you're supposed to have your shit together.
Oh, mate, I had Duncan Garner on the podcast recently, and we were discussing this because he's the same age as us. It's like, you know, when I was like 20, I'd see 50-year-olds, I'd think, that motherfucker's got it all figured out. And then you get there and you're like, oh, no, everyone's just figuring it out as they go along.
Yes.
Yeah, and the older I get, the realize the less I actually know.
Yeah, and I, brother, you know, it's like releasing all of that. We're holding a lot of guilt and we're all these expectations from people who don't give a shit about us.
Yeah.
And I heard this great thing. It's like the best weight you can lose is the weight of other people's expectations of you. Because that will bog you down on what people think of you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
But so before 2009, there were some... How often did you have like an episode where things started swirling? Like, there must have been some happy periods or some calm periods.
Oh man, it was amazing periods. Like that was either way up there or was way down here.
Yeah. Have you been diagnosed with like bipolar or anything?
My former therapist said I had bipolar traits, which I thought was really lovely. But if I look at humanity, man, we're all bipolar.
Yeah.
It's just we're all a little. We don't. No one wants to be diagnosed with anything. But I don't get caught up in the diagnosis anyway because you can be caught up in that. Doctors are going, you're this, you're bipolar, you're an alcoholic. I'm not saying me, but you know, you start handing out these labels, people start to think that's all they are.
Mm.
You know, I just boil it down to you're hurt. Mm. Okay, let's have a look at that. What do you need? You're hurt. Mm. Or we get stuck in this bullshit treadmill that just goes round and around in circles.
Mm. I just can't I don't know. Like this is the first time we've met today, but I've been following your work closely since after the 2009 incident, and you've done some great work in the mental health field since then. But I just can't imagine that you were not a great communicator. You know what I mean? Like you were a playwright, a very successful playwright. So you're good at communicating to an audience. Why were you not good at speaking about your own shit?
That's right. That's why do you think actors take up acting?
So they can be someone else.
That's right. Why do you think artists do you think artists want to be joining the arts? So they can express stuff that's not directly about them, but it's about this thing.
Okay, dumb question.
But no, it's not a dumb question because even artists sometimes forget. I've got a lot of good friends in the arts still, and I know they're challenged by this because the art form is also like sometimes like religion, it can be a barrier to your real healing. You can hide behind it. It's a great barrier to hide within. And it can save you too, but it's also a hindrance because you've got one thing in front of you that you're constantly using to keep in front of the hurt.
Mm.
Sorry, I'm putting this in the front of the mic. But yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the recovery. So you're in hospital 7 weeks, did you say?
9 weeks all
along. 9 weeks. And did you? Did they have therapists that came in to see you, or did you have a therapist on?
I tell you what, I had the best. I had the hospital psychiatrist, and she turned up in this 1980s suit with these big like shoulder pads, and was like, sort of like this blue block colour. And she came in here, she came with an assistant, and she went, hi, Rob, I'm the hospital psychiatrist. And I just want to sit down with you. And she started to ask me some questions, and then she said, you know, what's happened to you is normal for somebody with depression. I was like, depression? Oh, that's like that John Kerwin thing that I saw on the ads.
Are you where he's writing hope into the sand?
All of that. But can I just share a little on our side?
Yeah.
That when she said about the John Kerwin ad, when John Kerwin would speak about his problems on the TV and no one was around, I'd be telling John to shut up because him talking was irritating my demons. And so as I go around Australasia, sometimes me talking irritates other people's demons because they don't want to hear it. They've drunk enough, done enough drugs, or done enough whatever they have to squash it down. And when someone else is speaking as freely as you and I are, on the couch over there could be somebody going, what's those two? Shut the F up because, man, it's freaking me out. And so I understand that now. Before I used to think I was the problem for talking about it. I've been made to think that I was crazy because I was speaking out aloud. What I realize is you're crazy if you don't address this.
Mm. Yeah, John Kerwin. I had Sir John Kerwin on the podcast last year, and I gave him flowers for what he's done. Like he was the trailblazer in this mental, like he put everything on the line. I remember listening to Talkback Radio, and when there was one Talkback host that talked about, had a phrase, he goes, if someone's got the Kerwins, like it sort of talked about depression flippantly and almost made a joke about John Kerwin in a way. John Kerwin put everything on the line.
Absolutely.
And he's a big part of the reason that Mike King and you and everyone else that has come since feels a little bit freer to talk about these things.
Yeah, these people were trailblazers for me.
100%.
Especially as a male.
Yeah.
As a male, I was talking specifically for me as a male. And so, you know, you talk about Sir John Kerwin, Mike King. Mike King helped me on my journey. And
Did you know Mike before 2009?
No. I mean, of course I knew who he was.
Yeah.
But I didn't know him at all. So my mental breakdown, I ended up on the Nutters Club, which was
his radio show.
Which is still going. It's a great show. talking about mental health openly, and I'd never met. So I met Mike King and one of his right hand men, Boris Sokratov, and I'd never heard two males ever speak so openly and vulnerably, and normally about mental health, and it freaked me out. I thought this must be an alien planet. I've never heard men speak like this before, and it helped change the game for me. Not then, because it freaked me out, but much later down the track when I started the Shop Bro journey, I realised where the doorway was, because two brave males showed me what it's like to talk normally about your mental health.
Yeah. And I suppose in a way, like the Nutters Club and that platform that they gave you, that's it's kind of like the Brené Brown thing, eh? It's like you show vulnerability and it's like you put your cards on the table and then lets the other person know that it's a safe space and they can put their cards on the table too. But I heard another podcast that you did, and you talked about how this is way before 2009 and the shooting incident, where you got hooked up with a priest or something, and the priest tried to like get through to you by sharing some of his vulnerabilities, and then you responded by just saying like, "Nah, I'm all good." Or,
oh, it wasn't a priest. It was but I understand where that's coming from. It was actually at Victoria Park Market in the park,
just next door.
So somebody had seen something was wrong with Rob, and this Māori sort of gentleman, not sort of, Māori gentleman, a brother, sort of like an uncle, someone said, maybe you should talk to Rob. And he said, hey, meet up for a chat. Oh, yeah, because we're planting trees together. Anyway, he starts sharing stuff about his personal upbringing, and it was about child being abused as a young man. And what I realised what he was trying to do is what I'm doing and what Mike's done and what John Kuhn has done is that he was doing I call it the reveal to heal. So he's revealing some vulnerability to open the door for me to know that it's safe to talk about something vulnerable.
Yeah.
But I was in such deep denial. I was going, why is this guy telling me this crap for? There's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with me. I kept repeating that in my mind, because that's how scared I was. But I thought later on, much later down the track, after being shot, after recovering, I went, what an awesome man to be that brave to come and talk to me and open up just a little bit about what happened to him so he could reach out to me. I understand it now. I didn't understand it then.
Yeah. God, there's a lot of parallels with you and me and our journeys. Thankfully for me, my rock bottom hasn't been as deep as what yours is. But there's a lot of parallels. Were you always a all good person?
Yeah, all good. Oh, totally, bro. Yes. Well, you know it, eh? You know it. When you know it, you know. Yeah, I was totally all good.
All good.
And then I'll make you feel good about you too. Yeah. And then, you'll leave and I'll be tired. Like, oh, thank God, I'll just have to put on my real face now because I'm just tired. But I wasn't always
constantly had a mask.
I suppose not constantly. I suppose it's just confusing why my thoughts are swirling.
Yeah.
While I'm going, a massive emotional ups and downs. And then you add alcohol on top of that, you know, to try and drown it and have good times. I'm going to have good times. Obviously, what goes up must come down. Oh, no, now I'm hungover and this shit's 20 times worse. Oh, and so...
Yeah, it's a depressant. It's not good.
It's not good. And I used to use it quite a lot.
Yeah. So, the recovery. So you're in hospital for a long time. Then when does the stark reality of your situation kick in? Like the fact that you're in a whole lot of shit right now.
Just when I woke up. That's when I woke up in the hospital room and I was like, and my body's on fire.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like, once you get past, that's okay. Once you realise, okay, I'm going to live. Like, I literally dodged a bullet. And then you realise the legal implications of what you've done and the consequences for your actions. Like, what does your lawyer tell you? What are you looking at? You think it's going to be a 2 month imprisonment?
It was jail time.
Yeah.
But what those charges were for are for people who've done, has a criminal history, like probably a long criminal history. So it was quite, the charges were quite extreme. So the lawyer was just giving it to me pretty plainly. He said, like, you've got two charges, which is each 5 years in jail, and another two charges, which is 5 years in jail. Look, what if I can get it down to 1 year, Rob? And I said, I'll be dead, meaning I'll take my life.
Mm.
I was so mentally, physically, spiritually fragile.
Yeah.
I was ready to go. I didn't realize also I had survivor's guilt. That, oh, why am I still alive? Why am I, when other people have died, why am I still alive? So survivor's guilt on top of all of that.
Survivor's guilt about who?
About me still being alive.
Right.
Why am I still alive? I should be dead.
Yeah, but normally, I don't know, when I don't know much about survivor's guilt, but I'd think of it in a, like, say, a car crash situation. If there's you and three other people, and the other three people die, and you survive. But yeah, what do you mean survivor's guilt with the shooting incident?
Yeah, meaning I should be dead. Right. Like, other people were successful.
Yeah.
And okay. But also, let me just add to this: like, the hospital room next to me, this young Māori girl was fighting for her life. She had cancer. She died. And then I'm next door going, I'm messed up, and this girl's fighting for her life. And then on the I set up 7 weeks in particular in that hospital, a Chinese gentleman died in that same room. And so I'm like going, these people are fighting for their lives.
Yeah.
And this a-hole over here was trying to exit the planet. Mm. So all of that guilt on top of being alive, and these two souls in the room right next door to me had passed away over a period of weeks in between each other.
Did that sort of, I don't know, sort of firm up your resolve to live and get better in a way?
No. I was just, oh no, more guilt. How many layers of guilt can I wear?
Yeah.
Just to emphasize how much of a piece of crap I am. But what was quite surreal was people just giving their love to me, turning up, friends, family, turning up to my hospital room, just going, we love you, bro, and me, like, just confused. I was confused. I didn't believe I deserved any of this.
And what are you like with the outpouring of love from friends and family, maybe even people you haven't seen for years? Like, do you burst into tears when you see each and every one of them?
Sometimes I get pretty emotional.
Yeah.
Like, I just saw two close brothers of mine from the film world. And I just had lunch with them, and it's emotional because multiple reasons, I'm getting emotional now, is that these two brothers stood by me before, during, and after. And where some people took off, some people I thought we were mates. I chatted to Mike King about this, and he goes, come on, brother, have a look back. Think back to the time. Same thing happened to me, bro. These people were my friends, and they took off. Are you really surprised? And I was still. And then a couple of minutes later, I calmed down and went, actually, you're right. Mm. I perpetuated this circle so I could get into this party mode to hide. And I'm not saying they're bad. Anyone's a bad person. It's just that I knew where to go to if I want to drown and hide. There's a drowning and hiding circle called a party over here.
Yeah, and if you're no longer, I get that. Anyone that's had, like, drug or alcohol problems, it's like, you need to get rid of those friends, I guess. Friends or whatever.
Yeah, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You know, but
it's good in a way. It's like a purge, isn't it? It's like shaking an apple tree. And, the apples that stay on the tree, they're your life is.
Yeah, and that's who we were then. You know, they're different now. I'm different now.
Yeah.
But my mates who still stood behind me from that day, and I see them, man, I get emotional.
Mm.
I get emotional because I go, I just got to tell them that I love them. Oh, yeah, I love you too, bro. Okay, yep.
Are they better with it now, knowing what you've been through, or are they still a bit awkward about it?
No, they are, but, you know, it's a couple of times, like, oh, yep, But that's still good because that's just how they are. That must be how they are in their whole life, not just towards me.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is I've got the courage to say it to their face because I mean it.
But being a theatre guy, have you always been I find people I know that are in theatre, this is a sweeping generalisation, they're quite huggy, touchy people. Have you always been a huggy person or no? Were you like kind of hey, what's up?
I think, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. I think with the bros, you're always trying to be like the bros.
Yeah,
so whatever the bro code is, you just follow that.
Whatever the handshake of the week is.
Yeah, what a handshake of the week. Is it just a fist bump? Is it whatever? Is it the chair, bro?
Yeah.
And
you just
follow that. You follow that, yeah.
Yeah.
But theatre people are huggy people.
Yeah.
And I've turned into one of those huggers, especially when I meet genuine human beings, bro.
I think it's good. I've definitely become more of a huggy person as I've got older and more, in touch with my true emotions and stuff and more able to say what I'm actually thinking, which I think it's really cool. I like it. I like the journey I'm on.
Same.
You proud of the person you are today?
I am.
Yeah.
I am. And I've got to sometimes stop giving him a hard time because he's travelled a long way to get here. And I am. What I found out is from doing Shop Road, not found out, some people reflected back to me. It's like, oh, that young character you play, which is your younger self, it's like your younger self was searching for your older self to save you.
Mm.
Your hurt little boy was trying, got you through this crazy journey with the amount of tools that hurt little boy and a man's body had, and now this older Rob gets to look after that younger hurt little child that was stuck in time.
Yeah. That's a hell of a journey to get to where you are now, though. Well, not a journey you'd wish upon anyone.
No, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And I thought I hated people until I got shot. And when I hear people say, "Oh, that bastard needs a bullet," I was like, "Well, actually, have a good think about that."
You
obviously haven't had a bullet in you.
Mm.
Once you feel it, you'll realize who you don't really hate people that much. Yeah. Well, I don't. Anyway, I'll just talk about me. Yeah,
I've noticed that there's been a few occasions in this last 45 minutes that you've referred to yourself in the third person as Rob. Is that something you do intentionally? Like,
I suppose sometimes I do, because I'm like, I know it's me, but it's like there's versions of me throughout the timeline, and there's different versions of Rob Morgan.
So some versions of you feel like you're talking about a different person.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes. Mm. It feels like I'm talking.
That's interesting.
But I know it's me.
Yeah.
But I go, oh, that version. Oh, the 2.1, which was really messed up, and then I had to get to 5.
2.1. What version are we at now?
I don't know, man. 50 point. I don't know.
How good. Okay, so then the court case comes. So you're back at home. You're out of hospital. You're back at home.
So multiple surgeries, multiple court cases, and now that the body's slowly starting to heal, I start seeing a therapist.
Yeah. So physically you're feeling good. Mentally you're still fucked up.
Oh, mentally I'm a mess, and physically I'm a mess.
Yeah.
So both.
But you're alive.
I'm alive, but and I've got the love of my family around me, who are freaking out because it's not every day your son calls the police on them and is in the news that wanted to be dead.
Yeah. So did you have rally around? So there was almost someone. So you were almost on suicide watch, I guess, in a way, intense.
I didn't feel like it was. Maybe they felt like I never had that conversation. Yeah. But the main thing is, I mean, I was staying down the other end of the house, and my dad and my stepmom, and that was, they were looking after me. They had my own space, so I couldn't have been too concerned. Mm. I mean, they were concerned, but you know.
No, well, I suppose there's only so much you can do rather than.
Well, I was a mess already.
Yeah, and you can't keep someone in a padded room. Like, someone's going to do what they're going to do, ultimately, I think.
And unless you tie them up.
Mm. So when is the court case? So July 2009 was the shooting.
So, because I can't actually physically attend a court case, so we had the first court case in my hospital room.
Yeah.
So to clear the police out of there so I can actually have a healing space. And then I think 2010 is when I am able to walk into a courtroom with my guts cut wide open, but just stitched up.
Yeah. Have they given you a sentencing indication or a sentencing range? Or did you still think you were going to jail?
The Crown versus Rob Mukuraka and the police, they were trying to put Rob away from jail, but the extremity.
You're talking about him as Rob again.
No,
it's just an interesting observation.
Sorry, no, thanks for pointing that out. I didn't realise, because I'm doing it in Shop Pro when I'm talking about the multiple versions of me. So thanks for pointing that out, brother.
No, it's not a fault or anything, though. It's not something you should change. It's just interesting that the person that's sitting in front of me now almost disassociates from that person then.
Well, I can see it clearly what I was going through. So, he said, we had to go through multiple court cases, and this lawyer was very savvy, so we had to navigate these judges he knew were, and I'll say this very openly, he said they're box tickers for the police. Mm. They'll just, I am Sweeter's next, tick, and just on the conveyor belt. You're on the conveyor belt to prison, and especially as a Māori male, you're on the conveyor belt big time. So I had a very savvy, awesome QC lawyer who cared about me. Went, actually, this, and he knew some people up in the law, in the legal realm, who actually knew me and found out, actually, he's not a crazy psychopath. What I've heard is that he's actually he's a decent human being who spun out. So I suppose I've got a lot to thank him. I have thanked him.
Mm.
I sent him my documentary once I reconnected, and I think he just went, oh, okay. Well, at least you're not doing anything bad. You're using your superpowers for good, and I don't need my services again.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you've got a second chance at life. I mean, if you count up the other attempts, I don't know what number of life we're up to now, but it's like you're definitely not squandering it.
No, I'm not, and now I get to meet, I meet people like you, Dom. We've never met. So what I really cherish is many like-minded souls who are happy to talk about these very crunchy things so other people out there in the world who don't have the words or the courage yet can breathe a sigh of relief and go, okay, maybe I can get to that stage. I'm just right down here at the moment struggling.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you, brother. That's what I'm trying to say.
I appreciate you too. And as I was saying before, from doing this podcast, you realise that everyone's carrying a bag of shit. It's just how big that bag of shit is. Yeah. And I'd like to think people can hear your story and go, okay, well, he got through that. I can get through this relationship breakup, job loss, you know, this guilt that I've got for whatever it happens to be.
Absolutely. And if I could just give, I just try and drop real simple gems for people. I was like, you didn't choose the hurt, but you can choose to heal. Because we get stuck in here.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's it. Can't change anything. Well, I was like, well, you're not a tree, bro. You can move. So I was like, oh, I can move too. I can move to help. But it's just trying to, it's easier said than done when you're in that fight or flight all the time. And it's like you're literally walking through a storm that no one can see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens in court?
Oh,
multiple. So the lawyer's amazing.
Lawyer's amazing.
What do you get? Like community service?
The lawyer got me out of the prison sentence.
Well, I mean, look, like it makes sense, right? Like prison – Why would they send you to prison?
Well, because this is
I know you like you fucked up monumentally, but like prison's not a place to send someone that's just mentally unwell and trying in their life.
Yeah, so this is how the lawyer told it to me. He said, "Look, Rob, because you were filmed on the street by the news, and the public saw you, they need the police and the Crown to see you publicly get your ass kicked."
Mm-hmm.
So he's basically said,
make an example of it.
Yeah. He basically said it's a grey area. And and as messed up as the system is, I actually created that event. Mm. So I can't blame anybody for that event other than myself. So I created this event, which took a long time for me to get my head around, by the way. Mm. I was blaming everybody in the world but me.
Yeah, how long did it take you for the acceptance or ownership?
Years, up a couple of years. Years. I'd say a couple of years.
Right. Who were you pointing the finger at?
Oh, everybody. It's everybody's fault. The police's fault. It's the police's fault. It's people who
The police should have had tasers instead of the guns.
Yeah, and the police, everybody in my life, it was their fault.
Yeah.
And it was actually my cousin and his wife who loved me, and they said, hey, you know, if you didn't call the police on yourself. And they knew I was mentally fragile, and I didn't like hearing that, bro. I didn't like hearing it. Because when you're hurting, you need someone to blame. You caught them on yourself, so actually it's you.
It sounds like they told you in a really nice, gentle way, though. Like not giving you a boot up the ass.
No,
but
I was, bro, I was like, you could tell I was like mentally, unstable, fragile, physically fragile, mentally, spiritually, all of that. They saw that. But I really love them for that because I hated hearing it.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of pill to swallow, isn't it? No one wants to hear that. So you get through the court case, and excuse the pun, but did it feel like you dodged a bullet?
I'm sorry.
I'll edit that out. That was terrible.
No, you can keep it in there, bro, if you want. I did feel like I dodged a bullet because I thought if they did go to prison, I literally was going to take my own life.
Yeah.
Because I was paper thin, mentally fragile. My whole guts were still cut wide open. Everything mentally, spiritually messed up. But so I did feel like I dodged a bullet, and I was very grateful.
It's okay for you to say it, but I feel like I can't say it. Well, it's not my joke.
That's right. I pinched it off you. Shot, bro. And us normalising the thing about to talk about mental health and mental breakdowns, we've got to put light on the humour is helping to relieve the heaviness of what you're talking about. So I totally get it. And I was very grateful because, oh, cool, I don't have to take my life now. Where I was going to do that before.
So was that? Does that sort of feel like? So when the sentencing happened, so you've got that big, this big sort of hurdle or obstacle or whatever you want to call it in your life over and done with. Was that the point where you feel like you could take a deep breath and start rebuilding?
Kind of. Yeah? It's just that was just one step out. I had to rebuild. Like I was still mentally, physically. Walking wreck. And so navigating all of that, having to change my own wounds, was a good lesson of like, you have to deal with your own shit, Rob, literally. and you have to.
What's involved with changing your dressing?
So your colostomy bag.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So stop going to the toilet through your bowels, and now you're out your stomach, and they put your lower or large intestine, and they poke it out. Mm. And so because it was an emergency operation, it's burning your feces. My feces was burning the shit out of my skin. So basically I'm trying to clean the wound and get a clean fish on. And you're literally trying to hang out, have a social, try and be normal human, go to a supermarket or a cafe with a friend, and you shit yourself. All over your T-shirt, and I'm sprinting out of that cafe as fast as I can. So learning how to navigate that.
That's a lot.
And seeping, my guts are still seeping out. So I had to keep changing, cleaning my wound because they had to cut me open from the belly button to lower chest. So I'm navigating that as well as just trying to be normal, find out what normal is. That's what I was trying to. What is normal? Yeah. Is there any normal?
Yeah, there's a couple of people I've had on the podcast. I've had this former wakeboarder called Brad Smaler, who's now a quadriplegic, and he's got a permanent colostomy bag. And I had Di Henwood on, who's had bowel cancer, and he had a colostomy bag for a while. And I suppose I suppose in their position, because they didn't really bring it on themselves, you could have like an element of self pity. Did you have sort of self pity?
Oh, yeah. I had tons of it.
Did you?
Yeah. I was writing about it. I'm a writer. I was trying to write it all out, trying to write it out of me to get. I don't know. Because it was burning my skin. I was basically writing about that, and I was moaning about it until I was at my friend's barbecue, and my mate's dad. He goes, "Oh, you got one of those too?" And he pulls the shirt up, and I said, "How long is yours on for?" And he went, "Life," and I just shut my mouth. I stopped it
because you knew yours was only temporary.
Yeah, because mine was 4 months, and I thought, "What are you moaning about, Rob?" So you know, your pain, everyone's pain and hurt is valid. It's just get a perspective when you meet somebody who's going through something even bigger for life.
Yeah, there's a saying I've seen on Instagram that comparison is the theft of joy, and it's true. It's a good one, but you can always compare down, and there is always someone worse off than what you are.
Absolutely, but also. People get caught in the pain Olympics. Like, my pain is worse than anybody's in the world, and no one's ever going to understand. And then on the podium, you've got the bronze medalist going, "Oh, my pain is hurting me every day, but it's not as bad as that person's because they're telling me." But pain is pain, brother. Yeah. Hurt is hurt.
Yeah, it's
just getting a perspective.
There's no winner.
And there's no winner.
Yeah.
There's no winner.
Okay, so the court case is over with. We're rebuilding Rob. So when do you start to come right? How long is it? So July 2009?
Yesterday.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I understand you're still a work in progress.
Yeah, I totally
agree. If you suffer from mental illness, it's never going to fully go away, and it's a constant work on. But when did you start to feel like your old self again, or your new self again?
Well, it's interesting because as you're healing, you have to change your ways because can't physically do this, can't physically do that. Mentally, it's hard because your body's not working. You have to evolve. And now as I got better physically, I started to go back to my old dumb ways. So I'm like, let's have some beers. Let's get on it. Blah, blah, blah. And I mentally started to fall down again. I went, what's wrong? I'm back. I'm like, I'm feeling fit again. What's wrong with me? It's like, oh, you idiot. You can't go back to the old ways now. In my evolution, and anyone's healing evolution, you have to keep moving forward. If you try to go backwards, you're going to sink back down to where you were.
Yeah.
And that happened to me a few times. And that's okay. I mean, I was with good people, but when I realized that, I was like, oh, shit, this is not good for my mental health.
Yeah. And what about medication? You on medication now?
No, my new medication is BJJ.
What's BJJ?
Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, is it really?
I just taken it up. I'm pretty new, but yeah. I have a lot of friends who have done this.
Yeah, a lot of people swear by it. I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the key thing a mate of mine said is that it's mental and spiritual health because you're physically in your body. And I went, oh, okay. You get to try out a couple of free classes. I tried a couple of free classes. I was hooked. And now it's one of the many tools that I have on my healing tool belt.
Yeah.
So it's a physical outlet. Because you're very present. Because if you're not, you've got somebody about to choke you out.
Yeah, you've got to be in the moment.
Bar you. So you're very much not thinking about what's happening in 20 minutes time or 20 minutes ago. You're like, I'm very present. And I really enjoy it. And I enjoy that camaraderie amongst the club and team. And it's just bloody good for my well-being.
Yeah. What else have you got in your tool belt? Because I don't think there's when it comes to like a mental health plan or a resilience plan or whatever you want to call it, I don't think there's a one size fits all.
No.
You got to do the work yourself and find out what's right for you. But
yes.
What else you got? You do journaling? You do any ice baths or cold water therapy?
Well, look, I go to the ocean when it's cold. I go to the ocean when it's a hot day, rainy day, sunny day. I'll go to a river, a lake.
Cold water is the best.
Cold water is good for me. And and I do purification, meaning like I go in there doing karakia for myself to wash off what I don't need hanging around me, especially after I finish ShopRite presentations. Midi midi, romi romi, which are Māori forms of massage, which are physical and spiritual. Or if I can't find a Māori masseuse, I'll go to a Thai, because Thai can crunch the crap out of me and fold me upside down. And I really enjoy that physical, like, loosening up the limbs. And so I've got multiple, and I share this with everybody. I've got a tight three people that I trust with my life. I can text or call anytime, night or day, and I encourage other people to get a tight three, because it's too much for one person to hold. And the good thing about my tight three, it's grown to five people that I trust with my life, is that if you're swirling, that person's there to help you. And if you're the person helping the one swirling and it's too much for you, you call in the other people. So you're putting a circle of aroha and hope around that one person, and the three of you or five of you can navigate it better than one. So it's basically to even the load.
I think that's a good idea as a formal sort of – I mean, you hear about people that go to Alcoholics Anonymous and they have a sponsor, you know, someone that they can call any time, day or night. But we don't do that for mental health, do we?
No.
But everyone says, like, if you're ever feeling down, you give me a call, day or night. But it feels like it's just lip service.
Yeah, and that's why I took that step to go, I'm going to nominate these people.
And formalize it.
And, you know, it's okay if they go, oh, actually, it's a bit too much for me, bro. Yeah, okay, thanks, now I know. This person over here, this is another person. So you just build, and I've heard people say, I don't have a tight one in my circle. And I've actually said to them, sounds like your circle is crap. If you can't ask one person in your circle to be, you know, a guardian, a kaitiaki, you better change your circle, bro. Because that means it's not a safe place to be.
I like that. So when did the decision come to tour it and do ShopBro? As I said at the beginning, I watched this on YouTube last night, and anyone can watch it. It's a hard watch. And after watching it last night, I thought, you know, it must be exhausting for you to even come over here today and, like, chat about this for an hour.
No, this is my everyday, because it's not heavy for me.
It's not?
It's not heavy for me. It was heavy for me. It's light for me. Do I still have shed some tears about it sometimes? Yeah. But it's nowhere near as heavy as it's ever been for me. I'm at probably the best shape mentally, physically, and spiritually that I've ever been at. But I know that I've got to keep working on it. I can't just stop, like, go on cruise mode, because I'll start to slip backwards. The thing about prevention is you've got to be actually putting it into action. You got to be actioning. It's great to have all these tools, but if you're not practicing any of these tools daily, then it's just great thoughts and ideas. Oh, yeah. And then when the shit hits the fan and you go and grab the tool, you haven't actually used it before. You're like, I dropped it. I'll grab the other one. Oh, dropped it too. Oh, God. Yeah. And all of a sudden you think you've got these great tools, which you've never practiced using. And I had to figure out that the hard way, bro. That happened to me so many times. Yeah, that's great. That's a great one. And then when the shit hit the fan, they'd all fall out on the floor and I was lost again.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, the easiest time to do the work is when you don't need it, eh? But it's like, I mean, who does that? You know what I mean? It's like, I don't need it, I'm all good.
I totally.
Until you're not.
And that's what I used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
But now I've had to use these tools, and I encourage other people to use whatever tools you need, because we're all same but different. And you might need a little different variation of this. So figure out what you need. And when you're swirling in that storm of suicidal ideation, and you're brave enough to go, bro, I'm spinning out, I need help right now. The best advice I've ever got, and it's from my first cousin, Clint Edmonds. He said to me on the phone, what do you need, cousin? Because he could hear that I was distressed. And I'd never ever heard anyone ask me what I need. And I realized why, because I never told anybody I've been suicidal. So to have somebody actually listen without judgment, not go, oh man, we better medicate you, or geez, we better call the cops or call the ambulance. It's like, there's no panic. The person who I trust in my life, number one on my dialing list, is my cousin, just asking me what I need. And what I really like about that is it puts the ball back in that person's court to figure out, what do I need? because no one's ever asked me, do I need to cry? Do I need to go to the gym? Do I need to hit the punching bag? Go to the ocean? I don't know, but at least now someone's put it in your court to ask what you need. So it's actually having to build the capacity, getting the person to build it for themselves, but giving them a platform to work off.
And did I hear this on a podcast or did I hear this somewhere? After one of your shows of Shop Bro, you got the bash. Someone...
Oh, yes, my cousin.
So, is this
my
true?
Own cousin.
Really?
My own cousin. So we don't have alcohol around Shop Bro anymore.
Okay. Was this the catalyst?
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, yeah. So occasionally we'd been to, I'd like say, international theatre festivals. You know, everyone likes to grab a wine, we'll grab a beer, we'll grab a champagne, and we'll watch this thing about suicide for some weird reason they want to drink. So we're at this art gallery. It's an art gallery in the small community of Taniatua. And Tame Iti is our host. He's an awesome host.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's an awesome host. I meet my new cousin I never met before. What I didn't realise was he's had his own issues. And most people were drinking alcohol before I was even presenting.
Getting some pre's in.
Pre-drinks. And this cousin, I sort of listened to my instinct. He said, yeah, I'm feeling real nervous about what you're about to do. And I'm saying, whoa, because I didn't know. I was like, we're related. How cool. I've got a new cousin. This is awesome. This is what I'm thinking. Yeah. And he was like, I feel uncomfortable about what you're doing. I was like, well, I haven't even started. Oh, it's going to be sweet as. So he keeps getting on the piss. People are drinking and laughing. He's drinking on the piss. In the first five minutes.
He's just brooding.
He's brooding. Mm. I share this in Shop Bro. So stuff that happens to me on my life journey gets put into side Shop Bro, that presentation.
Oh, so the play just keeps getting longer and longer.
I edit some stuff out. But the thing is, it highlights that if somebody is swirling already and they've got this mask on, that they're this person in society, and you add alcohol and drugs, it amplifies that by 1,000. Mm. So what people are drinking, I had a couple of beers that night, and I was like, oh, okay, I feel good. I'm getting so much love from the community. I didn't realize that cousin was still drinking and sizing me up.
Yeah.
He was waiting for the last person to leave to smash me over. I didn't realize that. So what happened... took me by surprise, and I didn't take it too seriously because I better talk my way. We'll just get this calmed down. But I didn't realize how drunk he was and what he was in a fury, bro. So Tame Iti ended up saving my life because this dude knocked me to the ground. He was quite a big boy, and I was like, oh, shit, I'm in big trouble. I misread this whole situation with my rose-tinted glasses going, oh, man, this cousin's looking at me because he loves me. No, this cousin wants to smash the shit out of me because he's hiding from his own stuff and drinking up a storm. So from that, Tame saved my life. Very grateful, very grateful to him. We make sure there's no alcohol around Shop Bro because it goes into those crunchy parts that you're hiding. And I say this to everybody, alcohol and drugs amplify your internal taniwha or mental distress times 1,000. And at one international arts festival, I forgot to tell the festival not to open the bar. And they had a mini panic attack. And it was like, yeah, we're having wines. And I said, can you shut the bar? They're like, why? This is how we make money. And I was, this happened, and blah, blah, blah. Oh, shit, you didn't tell us. I know. Anyway, I explained why I'm feeling nervous about everybody drinking. And this lady came up to me afterwards, really well-to-do lady, and she went, you know what, Rob? Why are we drinking? Coming to a suicide prevention play, you made me question why we're all drinking when we should actually be having a cup of tea or water to actually process. And I thought, at least one person got it. The other people are like, well, shut the bar for, man. I'm going to get on it. This guy's crazy. This is Netflix on steroids. And I totally understand it. We're in a drinking culture which normalizes certain things. And if you don't question it, we'll just continue these habits. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but we're around mental health and mental distress. No drinking, bro.
Yeah. I feel like there is there's like a turning of the tide when it comes to alcohol. Like, I feel like if you go out now and you say, oh, I'm not going to drink, you're not going to get the same sort of judgment you would have got even like 5 or 10 years ago. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, everyone's a bit more chilled out.
Yeah.
Depends what circles you are, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know. The manlier ones. Come on, bro. What are you doing? What do you want, a bloody lemonade or something?
Yeah. 0.0. Why are you bothering?
Yeah, bro. Yeah. Why don't you just go home? But that's okay. That's cool, man. I'm down with that. I laugh at that. That doesn't mean, you know, I don't take it personally.
Yeah. And when you get out of bed in the morning now and you look in the mirror, do you like the Rob that you're seeing?
Yeah, I take my mental health very daily. I do the Te Whare Tapawha, which is the four pillars, mental, physical, spiritual, and family and environment. That's the fifth one. Mm. And I check in on those every day inside myself. How am I mentally? How am I physically? How am I spiritually? How is my whānau, meaning my two daughters in particular? And my partner and my environment. And I go, cool, my environment is safe. So I'm all about safe places, brother. So daily I'm checking on my mental health every morning.
Yeah.
I wake up like that. Okay, got a sore knee. Okay, getting old. BJJ, you're an old man. Okay, ouch. Ow, sore back and knee. Okay. But I'm okay. How's the mind? I'm okay with the body, yeah. But,
yeah, welcome to the 50s.
And but it's cool, bro. And I've got that's my diagnostic, my daily diagnostic. Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to bring up and ask you some questions about your daughter. So she was 4 years old at the time. So when did she find out about things, or how did she find out about things?
Well, she was in hospital coming to visit me. We didn't tell her.
Yeah, at four, I suppose, she doesn't need to know.
She just needs to know dad's sick and needs love. And she would turn up with my ex-partner, who I'm really good friends with.
Cool.
And just hold my hand and walk me around the ward like she was the adult and I was the child, because I had to relearn how to walk again. So my 19-year-old now still doesn't want to see Shortbro, but my 12-year-old daughter has seen Shortbro about 5 times throughout with her mum and her aunties and her cousins. And her big thing for me was like, Dad, that's not going to happen again, is it? And I was like, well, no, actually, thanks for asking, but no, because Dad was hurt, angry, scared, confused, and Dad's got more tools now. Dad knows he needs to talk about his emotions. So we're allowed to talk. And also I'm making sure that she knows that she's got permission to talk about her emotions.
Yeah.
Don't bottle that shit up, man. That explodes.
Mm. Yeah, it doesn't go anywhere, does it? It needs to be addressed sooner or later. And if you address these things as they come along, it saves that pile of dirty laundry from getting bigger and bigger.
Absolutely.
But why does she's 4 at the time, she's 19 now. Why does she not want to see it? Too hard?
Yes, it makes her too emotional. Yeah. She knows what happened to Dad. She knows what happened to me. It's just that, like, I don't want to see it and feel it. She gets sad, you know. It's like, Dad, I don't want to see you looking hurt. I don't want to see you. Even though we just hung out on the weekend having a great time and watching Netflix, eating popcorn and ice cream, still, it's okay. That's where she's at emotionally and mentally. Like, I don't want to see Dad in that space.
Yeah, well, imagine how different her life would have been, like, had you been successful.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's a lot for a kid to carry around.
Absolutely. So I had a friend of mine. So when I survived this, as I'm on the healing process of two hospitals, I had a friend of mine, say to a female, say to me, I'm really grateful to see you alive and doing well. I didn't tell you this, but my dad took his life. And I was like, what? I've known this lady for quite a few years, and I never knew that. Mm. And she goes, I'm the survivor of a parent who took his life.
Yeah.
And I was like, I felt instant aroha for her. I mean, she's a good person already, but that really amplified my survival.
Yeah.
Especially for both daughters, but for my eldest in particular.
Yeah, that's really powerful stuff. This is probably a great place to end it, but I know you've given the police officer involved a letter, but you don't know what the response was. It's very unlikely, but say he was to ever view or listen to this podcast, what would you want him to hear?
Just what I wrote in the letter. I am truly sorry I created that event and put you in that situation. I wasn't myself. I was somebody who was swirling in unresolved trauma, spinning out of control. So my aroha to you and your family, and I hope that you're safe and healing. And please know that if I could meet you with my good friend, Lance Burdett, former police negotiator, over a coffee sometime, that would be amazing. Lance Burdett actually said to me, Rob, I'm a policeman who had a mental breakdown in the police force. I'd be happy to facilitate. So if that person is out there, just want to send my aroha, my respect, and just say I'm sorry. I'm really, truly sorry. And I'm using this now to help people. And also, I'm trying to get into the police because I get invited into military bases, by the way. And so the police have been courting me because I'd be able to help them of how to deal with somebody in mental distress and help police look at their own internal systems, how to look after themselves.
Yeah.
So that's a process that comes in and out of the light by with occasional emails.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, whether or not that police officer involved, I suppose he's a victim in this thing as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Whether or not he's forgiven you, that's out of your hands. But have you forgiven yourself?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I have. Now that I've unpacked where it all came from, I understand how that happened. And I explained that in the documentary.
Yeah.
And I explained this in forums after Shopro presentations. It's kind of like my friend said, well, I see what you've done, Rob. You've synthesized. I was like, oh, what? She says, you've synthesized therapy, theatre, and Māori culture to create a healing package. I went, have I? Okay, I'm going to pinch that. But I want to share this. A lot of people help me get here, brother. But when I didn't believe in myself, when I didn't think I was worthy enough along this journey. So I've got a lot of whānau and friends and new friends who've helped me on this journey to be here today.
I feel like that's a great place to end it.
Yeah.
Keep doing your great work.
You too, brother.
Yeah, man, there's a reason you survived and you're definitely not squandering it, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, brother. Thanks for this podcast.
Rob Mokadaka on the Dom Harvey podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you got something useful from that episode. Look, I know it was a hard listen in parts, but this is life. This is a reality. It's not always like a Pixar movie. So I can't thank Rob enough for sharing his experiences, as hard as what they are. Again, if this content has raised some issues or concerns for you, please go to the episode description for a list of numbers and resources that can help you. And if you have any feedback, you can find me on Instagram, domharveynz, or you can email me, domharveynz@gmail.com. This episode was made possible by my friends at Radix Nutrition and Generate KiwiSaver. Radix Nutrition is, in my opinion, the best thing to come out of the Waikato since the Chiefs, and their products are, in my opinion, the yummiest thing to come out of the Waikato since Richard Kahui. Check them out at radixnutrition.co.nz and support the legends who support the podcast. Radix, by the way, spelled R-A-D-I-X. And the newest podcast sponsor, Generate KiwiSaver, who are now officially my KiwiSaver provider. I switched over as a way of thanking them for the support, and it was easier and quicker than I expected. And totally pain-free. Actually, form-free as well. All I needed was some ID and my IRD number, and that was it. Learn more for yourself at generatewealth.co.nz. There you will find a copy of their product disclosure statement, and the issuer is Generate Investment Management Limited. That website again, generatewealth.co.nz. Okay, thank you so much for making it all the way through. I am so grateful to have you along on this journey, and I do hope to see you next week for another episode of the Dom Harvey Podcast. See ya.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack
for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.